Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 574. It's the 1st of September, 2016. On the podcast today, I have CEO of Tolu Energy, TLOU, Tony Gilby. Talks about progress in Botswana and answers private investor questions. I also have chairman of Burnbrae and visionary entrepreneur Jim Mellon answers submitted questions about the economy, Brexit and life, which is the AIM listed cash shell he's involved with right now at the moment. That's LIFE. And I've got to say, I've got to thank Jim for taking the time out there. He was in Ibiza and he had to go to the local cafe to get an internet connection. So it does dip out now and again, but I thank Jim for the time. Also on today's podcast, the top five most followed companies on the Vox Markets website in the last 24 hours. And there's no surprise at number one. It's a hugely popular stock who had a massive rise yesterday. I'll cover that in a bit. And also, I have the most liked and disliked RNSs on the Vox Markets website today. No surprise there either. Plus, I also have today's suggested one for your watch list, been submitted by Paul, and it's Prospect Oil and Gas, PXOG. I'll cover the reasons why Paul thinks this is a good pick for your watch list in a bit.
The Vox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Executive Officer of Tolu Energy, that's TLOU ticker. It's Tony Gilby. Thank you for coming on, Tony.
Morning, Justin. Thank you.
Morning. Now, you're in Brisbane. What's the time there? I've got to say, it's 11 o'clock in the morning here, nearly. What's the time there?
Oh, it's 7:30 in the early evening, so a very civilised hour, Justin.
Okay, excellent stuff. Well, listen, I spoke to Colin twice. He's finance director, isn't he, Colin?
He is indeed. He's based over there in your part of the world. He looks after general public relations and investor relations in the UK area, and he's also our CFO, so finance director and CFO.
Yeah, well, when I first talked to Colin a while back, this is when the first time, you know, Tolu came on my register, on my radar kind of thing, and I always like to use an acronym, and I went through this acronym with him, and that's basically CASH, and C stands for cash, A stands for assets, S stands for shareholders, and H stands for head honcho. And I liked it. I went through the entire sort of acronym with him, and I liked what I heard with Tolu. And so but I haven't spoken to you, but I've spoken to Colin twice. So as you're the sort of main man there, I suppose it'd help if we go through your background, because it's very interesting. And I've read a bit about Arrow Energy. Before we get into what Tolu does, I just want to talk about your background there. So can you explain what you did with Arrow Energy? And it's pretty much the same kind of company. When I say that, is it coal bed methane as well, wasn't it?
It was indeed, certainly, Justin. Brisbane, where I'm based, the reason why I'm here is this is essentially the epicenter of coal bed methane in the world. We took over from the USA. It was a very much a pioneering industry in the late 1990s, but we could see where things were developing, and we saw our friends in the US make it into a very large, very profitable industry. So in the year 2000, I got together with some colleagues and we founded a company called Arrow Energy. And that started out as a very small company, as did Tolu. And Arrow was eventually taken over for about $3.5 billion from memory. A little bit after I was helped found Arrow Energy, I founded another company by the name of Sunshine Gas, and with Sunshine Gas I took on the MD role from very early on and steered Sunshine Gas through the growth phase, the real growth of coal bed methane in Queensland, and we sold that to the BG group eventually for over $1 billion. So there were two very profitable success stories in the early years of my Brisbane experience, Justin.
Yeah, so it looks like you know what you're doing when it comes to coal bed methane.
I think so, and I would hope so. And myself and my team have learned a number of lessons over the years, and certainly on the resource side, how to deal with governments and the market is all very important, and it all comes together to hopefully make shareholders money and wealth for the general citizenship in terms of a reliable source of relatively clean and efficient energy.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, if you do it once, you know, that's, you can think, if you can, well, it's a one-off. But, I mean, twice you've taken small, barely double-digit market cap companies to billion-dollar market cap companies, which is, you know, it's an amazing, you know, achievement. So why have you now focused on Botswana?
After the Sunshine experience, and that culminated a little bit before the Arrow takeover by Shell. But after Sunshine, I took a little bit of time off, and our team, I was still effectively had the team together. We looked all around the world for comparable opportunities in the early stage, if you will, the unrecognised stage of CVM development. Others had dabbled before in Botswana, unsuccessfully. But we did see in Botswana all the key elements, and that was consistent widespread coal, evidence of gas, a good government to work with, a proactive government, and indeed the potential for a high product price because of the great energy need in Botswana and all of southern Africa. So we ticked all those boxes and we thought, well, this should be pretty straightforward. We'll go over there after our experience in Queensland. But of course, going into a completely different country in the early days, there were a number of setbacks, but two steps forward and one step back. But we've been going at it now for a number of years in Botswana. I think we're very, very close to being in a position to see some real results and some real light at the end of that tunnel, Justin.
Yeah, and like I said, do you see, I mean, obviously we're talking big figures here, and if everything goes right, there's a lot of things that have to be done, of course, in the future, you know, mid to long term. But do you see the same kind of potential, you know, in Botswana as you realised with Sunshine Gas and Arrow Energy?
Short answer is yes. However, I can qualify that further by saying I see much more potential, much more potential. And it's because of Africa, perhaps surprisingly when we first went in there, has proven to be quite a low-cost operational environment. Once you get up and running, there's a number of very skilled technical people with which to draw on, and indeed a solid and well-advanced drilling industry. So we can actually drill wells cheaper in Botswana. The product price, effectively linked to power prices and the high alternative fuel costs, is also much higher than Queensland. So effectively, on the cost side, it's much more competitive, and on the product price side, it's much more attractive than Queensland. So if anything, it should be better than Queensland, Justin.
Wow. Okay, and so you said that, you know, when you first started there was some issues, or, you know, working in a different country. But I know you've got a guy there, you know, who's very experienced on the inside there. That's, you call him Gigi Gabaki. So how has he helped you, and how did you hook up with Gigi?
Gigi was the permanent secretary of the relevant department that looks after minerals and energy and water. And Gigi was with that department for many, many years and worked his way up. He's a geologist. And they're very kind to their public servants over there. They retire them in their mid-40s. So Gigi got to retirement age and thought he's a bit young to hang up all of his pencils and pens and geologist pick and all that, and he was looking for another opportunity after he retired. And he was one of the initial driving forces within the country that recognised the potential of CVM. So we were looking for an in-house or an in-country person, and Gigi became available, and we got together in a loose sense in the early days, and then gradually we've become much closer together, working much closely together. Now Gigi is very senior within the company, and indeed the top man in the country for us.
Okay, yeah. So as yet, can you explain sort of where you are, you know, in Toulouse development history? At what point, and are you as yet happy with everything that's happening?
I, apart from the occasional unforeseen setback, Justin, I'm very happy with where we are at the moment. The whole process has taken a little longer than originally expected, and I guess that was perhaps we're a little bit too optimistic, a bit too bullish in a new country. But over the last 18 months to 2 years in particular, we've really found just the right people to assist us in terms of all the service providers. The government itself has advanced a lot in terms of their thinking in relation to new energy sources. For example, they're looking at developing solar, they're looking at developing CBM, and they've just recently announced a 50 megawatt CBM deal, which is the first one in the country, and that, of course, Talao Energy has 50 megawatts of that new CBM power generation project. So they're really recognising the industry now. They recognise that if you have gas, it's a good, clean fuel, and it fulfils many of the requirements of a reliable energy industry. And indeed, they like solar, for example, as well. But solar works very, very well hand in hand with gas, as you know, because gas can be 24 hours a day and peaking, etc. Whereas solar, you know, you've got to have the sun shining, and indeed storage capacity.
Yeah. Okay, and the most recent news was the oversubscribed placing to raise $3 million, and involved in that was IK and GE. Can you explain your relationship with these companies, please, Tony?
Yes, IK Holdings and GE approached us some time back to work together towards a power generation, the first gas to electricity power generation project in Botswana. As you know, GE is a worldwide company, and having talked with them and worked with them on and off over the previous period of time, I've become to understand that they have a lot of a faith in the growth of power in Africa, and they want to be intimately involved with that. Now, in Botswana, it's universally known as being a great place to do business. It's known mainly for its diamonds, of course, the world's largest producer of diamonds, but also it's a good, stable government, and it has a very high GDP. So, effectively, GE has recognised that an opportunity to produce power in Botswana is a good one for them, and indeed they're only missing one key component, and that is gas. We're the leading gas producer, or will be the leading gas producer in Botswana. We're the leading proponent of CBM at the moment, and to get a gas-fired power generation project off the ground, they need gas, so they need Talao. So they found us, and we liked the concept of working with such a large, reputable company such as GE, and IKH were the facilitator of the arrangement, if you will. So the group came to us and said, yes, they would like to have us sign a cooperation agreement to advance the concept of gas to power in Botswana. They recognise it has a great upside for such a large company such as GE, but clearly it also has lots of upside for us. Now, this, in the consummation of the signing of the most recent cooperation agreement, IK expressed interest in owning some Talao shares and contributing to our cash balance, if you will. So that's how the placement initially came about, and we decided to increase it slightly to include some others, we weren't able to go too far and wide, and we had to do it in a reasonably tight time frame. So it all came together in the end, notwithstanding the usual hiccups of capital raisings. And the good news about the capital raising, again, notwithstanding any little lingering issues out there, which I think are all tidied up now, but the good news about the capital raisings in this case, and certainly in Talao's case, is it takes any funding risk out, near-term funding risk out of the equation for the company. So that's when new investors and existing investors look at Talao, they don't have to be worried that we're going to go out and raise money. That's all done, that's behind us. We're good now for quite a long period of time, which we can really just concentrate again solely on developing the gas. Now, we're already the leading CBM gas company in Botswana. That makes us the leading CBM gas company in all of Southern Africa, so we get a lot of attention, a lot of interest from many parties. Our objective now is to continue to consolidate that position, to grow that position, and to grow the resource. And in doing so, that will attract more interest and allow us to do better deals for our shareholders.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've got a couple of questions here, maybe from shareholders, but first one here is, what is the impact now the Botswana government have decided to upgrade and expand the coal-fired power station at Moropole B?
Moropole B is the potentially the largest existing power station in Botswana. It unfortunately has not worked to capacity since it was completed some time back, and there's been a number of technical issues with it. And invariably, only about 25 to 50% of Moropole B to date of about 600 megawatts has been functioning at any one time. That's meant that the government has had to go externally and purchase electricity from outside the country. Now, that's a great cost to the government and the people of Botswana. So they're very keen to expand their existing capacity, both by coal, by solar, and of course by gas. And the expansion of Moropole into module 7 and 8 has been something that they've been planning for some time, and that will assist in their ultimate goal of being self-sufficient in electricity generation. The interesting thing about it, though, is that it really is very complementary with what we're doing with gas. And indeed, obviously, it's mainly baseload. Gas can be baseload and peaking. And the other key aspect to any coal-fired power generation, as you and your listeners probably know, Justin, is that coal is not considered to be that clean a fuel. So whilst they're expanding Moropole, and that's through sheer need to try and increase their generative capacity, they also know that they want cleaner sources of energy, and we don't view that as being a negative at all.
Yeah, okay. So next question is relating to the power project there, and you've had a 50 megawatt power project approved by the Botswana government, which is five times bigger than you wanted. But the question is, once the 10 megawatt pilot plant is built and operational, does the expansion to a 50 or 100 megawatt require building a complete new plant or facility, or simply an extension or upgrade of the existing one?
It is the latter, Justin, and that is the beauty, the real beauty of gas, because it's very, very simple to upgrade. Once we get the first generation of electricity from gas in Botswana, it is purely a mechanical process to increase that capacity. The plants can be built offshore, they can be brought in modules and just dropped down next to the previous one. And as long as one plans for growth within the initial design, one can start out very small and then rapidly expand once the project is effectively de-risked. So very easy to expand, and because gas can be switched on and off and is a much cleaner fuel than coal, it has many more positive aspects. So I think we're sitting in a very desirable location.
Nice. Okay. And question here, why does the renewed agreement with GE and IK expire so soon after it was agreed?
Well, we started negotiating the deal a little while ago, and it only came together relatively recently, so that took up a little bit of the time. But the objective all round was to keep the time frame fairly short, Justin, and the idea of that is it keeps the pressure on all parties to come up with something more concrete, something that we can really then use to grow the project sooner rather than later. So it just keeps the pressure on all parties to move along quickly and not let the project stall, because we're already flaring gas, as we've announced to the market some time ago. And the sooner that we get that into a power station, start selling that gas, the sooner our shareholders can start getting a return.
Marvellous stuff. Well, listen, Tony, I think that's enough to be going on with, but I'm going to put you on the spot here. I'm going to ask you to give me three reasons why investors should put Talao on their Vox Markets watch list. And this is, you know, basically a summary of what you just said. And so if you can come up with those three, I'd be much appreciated, please.
Most certainly, Justin. I would summarise it. I think my top three would be, we've done it before, so we know the subtleties, and we don't get put off at all if there are any little setbacks. We know where we're going and how we're going to get there, all else being equal. That's the first point. The second point is, we are by far the market leaders in CBM in Botswana and therefore all of Southern Africa. So we'll continue to grow our project and to consolidate that market-leading position. And I think the third point is that we're, of course, flowing gas now, and we'll be looking at converting those gas flows into reserves. We're working on that very hard, and then we will be looking at taking that gas into an energy-hungry market, which has a very high product price. So all that translates to an enormous upside for shareholders, Justin.
Yeah, and of course you didn't add that you are a shareholder yourself, aren't you? Quite a significant one.
I'm currently the largest shareholder, and I've put the most cold hard cash into the company to date.
Yeah, so you obviously believe it. Tony, thank you very much for coming on, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Very good, Justin. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chairman of Burnbrae, it's Jim Mellon. Thanks for coming on, Jim.
Oh, thank you for having me, Justin.
Now, I did ask how I should introduce you. You said that. I think it's quite modest because, you know, I was looking around the internet there and there's lots of superlatives and excellent, you know, sort of descriptions of yourself there. And I think, you know, you've underdone yourself, undersold yourself there a little bit because I can see you've, you know, you are basically, you're a millionaire by the 28, by the age of 28. You feature regularly in the Sunday Times Rich List. Now, the last one featured you at 138. With a fortune of £850 million. How accurate is that, Jim?
It's quite hard to say, to be quite honest. I really don't add it up. But I do have a lot of property in Germany, which I guess has gone up a lot in value. So that will have a big swing effect. But since we haven't we're not interested in selling it, it's hard to say exactly. But I've been very fortunate. I've also worked very hard, and you know, so there is money around at the moment. But yeah, great fortunes can come and go, as Philip Green is about to find out, and other people have found out. So I try and diversify as much as possible so that I don't lose everything in one go, basically. And I certainly don't take huge gambles on anything.
Yeah, yeah. And so, for people who don't know, if you can give a sort of summary, Jim, so how did you start off, and, you know, what was your first, you know, big sort of discovery in the money field, and where did you make your sort of big bucks, first and foremost?
Okay, well, I think, as I said earlier, I've been quite lucky. I left university at the age of 20, and I was sent to by a company called GT Management, which is now known as LGT. And it was an entrepreneurial fund management company. Now, honestly, I could have gone and worked for Clark Shoes, or I could have gone and worked for Unilever. I mean, I really just put the job that gave me an overseas opportunity, and I knew nothing about fund management. But it happened to be a time where fund management was, you know, growing rapidly. People wanted their monies managed, and particularly they wanted them managed in emerging markets, which is what GT Management specialized in. So they sent me to San Francisco, time in Hong Kong. I lived there for a few years, and my boss got fired. And so at about the age of 24 or 25, he took me, because I was the only one who was willing to go with him, to Hong Kong. And I became both a shareholder and the Hong Kong representative, if you want, of his new company. And within 3 years, the company was sold to a German bank for a reasonable amount. So as you say, at the age of 25, I ended up with... you know, a reasonable amount of money. It was a lot of money at the time, let's put it like that. And that gave me the opportunity of starting my own company, which is still in existence today. I'm not interested in fund management myself, but we still have a fund management company. And it's based in London called Charlemagne Capital. But I've been, since then, evolving through a series of activities. The mining business, biotech, property in Germany and elsewhere, and most recently in sort of new technologies. So, you know, I'm quite flexible in what I'll do for money, as long as it's kind of legal.
Yeah. So what, I mean, obviously, you know, you're a very well-off man, you've been very successful. So what still motivates you? What gets you out of bed and excited in the morning?
Well, I'm really interested in new activities and the impact that they can have on both human development and on the world. And so, for instance, I've now done 5 books with my co-author Al Chalabi, the most recent of which was called Fast Forward, and that led to a company being listed on the London Stock Exchange called Fast Forward, funnily enough. Our new idea or venture is to talk about anti-aging and the impact on the world and what investments are going to be good in anti-aging. And by anti-aging, I don't mean slabbering cream on your face. I mean, genetic interventions, the use of organs that are grown outside the body in animals or in stem cell scaffold structures to really extend life beyond the maximum level, which is about 120 that that people experience today. And I think we're in that era now, and it's going to have a very, very big impact on lots of things. In terms of motivation, it's really interesting to me. It's interesting to be able to write a book about it and to form my investment. And subsequently, we will list the company at the same time as the book comes out, sometime in the second quarter of next year, to invest in the opportunities that are described in the book, basically.
Okay, excellent. Well, I got to say, you're breaking up a little bit. That's because you've gone to a cafe, because you're in Ibiza, I know that, and you've got connection there, but it a little dipped out a little bit, but it's fine. So we've got some questions here. I submitted a little survey saying, if you have any questions for Jim, please send a question in. So we've got a few here, and one of the first ones is, what's your feeling on the EU referendum vote and where we are at the moment? And you voted to leave, didn't you, Jim?
Well, I don't have a vote because I don't live in Britain and haven't done since I left university. But I supported the Brexit camp, and I supported it for economic reasons rather than for dog whistle reasons to do with immigration or sovereignty or whatever. And my economic reasons are largely to do with the coming implosion of the EU currency. I'm absolutely convinced that it can't persist in its current form, that it's absolute disaster for the European Union. And it's, for instance, put people who are young, and by young I mean up to age 34, out of jobs in Southern Europe. So we have 50% unemployment here among the EUs in Spain, the same in Italy, Greece, Portugal, and very high unemployment among young people in France. And that is directly the result of the imposition of a one-size-fits-all monetary policy on countries operating at different speeds. It's been to Germany's advantage, of course, but it's been very much to the economic disadvantage of the southern European countries. I don't think that situation can persist, so I'm pretty sure that the euro is going to break up. So for that reason, I thought that the UK would be better off outside the Union. Now, where we are today is that I think we've been lucky with Theresa May being elected as actually sort of acclaimed as Prime Minister. I think she's a very, very solid operator who will take good advice. The fact that in both Article 50, I think it's extremely, I think we should be getting an idea of what deal we're going to have before we invoke the Article 50, when we lose leverage in negotiations. My general sense is that all the doomsayers, including George Osborne and the puppets of economists and the luminaries who said that it was going to be a disaster, are being proved wrong day by day, because we can see that even today, you probably saw manufacturing figures that came out, which show much, much than expected retail sales and much stronger than expected. Consumer confidence is in a pretty good, robust shape. And of course, our exports are benefiting from the depreciation of sterling. So my general view is that this will be okay for the UK, and but I do think that some radical changes need to be made, one of which is that we should move to a much simpler tax code. And obviously, with Apple's troubles in Ireland, we have a big opportunity to suck that kind of business into the United Kingdom if we move to a zero or very, very low corporate tax rate. And that would be one of the recommendations I would make were I ever to be asked, which is most unlikely, to make such recommendations. And the second thing is, I think that the government, I think these low interest rates are not going to stay for very long, because I can feel inflationary pressures building up in the world. And but now the government has an opportunity of borrowing vast amounts of money at 1%. And it should do so. It should borrow for 100 years, and it should borrow as much as it can, and I would think up to £1 trillion, because the lesson is that of very high indebtedness ratios in France, First World War, Second War, is that debts rose by inflation in due course. But the government would then have an opportunity to spend that money on infrastructure projects and on continuing education and better education overall, which is key to the modern economy. And if they did that, I think that the UK could be the fastest growing developed country in the world, would certainly outpace all its European rivals by a country mile. And then the third, we should just remove all tariff barriers and say we're completely open to trade with anyone with no tariff. And that would be by far benefit. It would send a signal that we don't really care what protectionist barriers Europe puts up against us, because there's lots of other countries to trade with. And it might just lead to the genuine reform of the European Union, which is absolutely, you know, urgently needed. So I think those three factors would be what I would recommend. I don't think that there's anything wrong with a simple tax code. I think there's anything wrong with a simple economy and a minimal government. And it only works in Hong Kong, Singapore, and where I live in the Isle of Man, which obviously is very small, but has had compound rate of economic growth for 34 years with no down year of 6% per annum as a result of the simplicity of its economic structure. So that was a bit of a long rant, but there you have my view, basically.
No, but it sort of makes sense. And even though I suppose, you know, from Theresa May's point of view, it's quite radical, it does make sense from a business point of view. Now, part of this, you said, is they should sack Mark Carney. Do you still believe that?
I absolutely do. There is a natural rate of interest which is appropriate for any economy, and it goes by the so-called Wicksell rules. And what he's done is to compound the pernicious effects of quantitative easing and manipulated low interest rates. The effect of that is to crowd out the private sector in the money game. So the government basically has access to cheap money, but no one apart from large corporations who don't need it has such access, and that's why small companies and medium-sized companies find it difficult to be financed. The second problem with his manipulative policies is that they allow zombie companies to carry on when they should actually be put out of business by their normal rate of interest being a burden on their debt. The third is that it erodes the savings of a nation, and it destroys the savings industry, and it also has a very negative effect on banks. As you know, the banks' net interest margins are being compressed. Banks are not able to repair and to build their balance sheets, and banks become very risk averse in terms of lending, which is the method of transmission of credit into the real economy. Now, his idea, of course, is that by forcing people to chase yield and riskier assets, somehow or other, that's going to spur the economy. We've seen in Japan, we've seen in Switzerland, we've seen in Germany, negative interest rates or very low interest rates do not work. And what he should have done is sent a signal, which is what Mrs. Yellen is going to do in either September or December, that the economies are normalizing, and to raise interest rates, not to lower them. Now, he left Canada in a huge mess when, you know, Canada's got serious economic issues, and they're largely down to him. So Osborne hired the wrong guy. He's an academic stroke Goldman Sachs tinkerer, and I think Mrs. May should fire him. I think he's entirely the wrong guy for the job. In fact, bring back Mervyn King if he's prepared to come back, because he was very good.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so some questions are not related, really. I suppose they are in a certain way, but next question is, I read in your column you're a fan of gold and silver. Is that still the case?
Yes, we have a show every year, which I think you've been to, actually, called the Master Investor Show. And at Master Investor, I said, look, you know, I think put one third of your assets into gold and silver or gold mines or ETFs or whichever way you want to do it, or even buy Britannia as a sovereign, put your capital gains tax free and carry VAT. So you have physical gold because inflation's coming back. You know, the effect of all this huge money printing around the world one day will come and bite us in the rear, basically. And I can see inflationary pressures building right now. They may not be evident in the figures, but the figures I don't think are necessarily right, because in services inflation is definitely there. So if you're a consumer of coffee shop time, whether you're a consumer of hairdressing services or a consumer of almost anything that involves labor other than manufactured goods, the prices are going up. And the deflationary effect on textiles and electronics, which we've seen coming out of China for the last 10 to 15 years, as well as from technological processes, progress is coming to an end. So you're not going to get that benefit in terms of the inflation figures. And oil prices seem to be going up, and in fact, commodity prices are recovering. So I think we're going to see inflation, and in those circumstances, gold and silver do very well indeed. And so I would absolutely be long of them at the moment, because Gresham's law says that bad money drives out good money. The governments are doing everything they can to create inflation. One day they will have their wish. I don't know if that day is very early. And when they do get that wish, you could see inflation in the double digits again. And of course, in those circumstances, gold could go to $2,000 an ounce, if not more. So I'm very bullish.
Yeah, wow. Okay, you mentioned briefly Philip Green earlier. We've got a question here saying, if the Bank of England increases pension fund deficits by its own policy, why should Philip Green pay up for BHS pensioners?
Well, that is a very good point, that, you know, the Bank of England, as I said earlier, has effectively made it much harder for pension funds to match their assets with their liabilities. That having been said, Philip Green didn't make a sufficient contribution to the pension scheme when he was in control of the company. I don't know why companies can make their own decisions as to how much they contribute to pension schemes. There should be some sort of mandatory figure that leaves the pension schemes in good fettle, rather than him taking all the money out in the form of a dividend. I mean, I think he really is a rapacious and unacceptable face of capitalism. I don't think he's acted honorably. And now it's probably too late for him to make up the deficit, because I doubt very much whether he's got £600 or £700 million of cash down the back of his sofa on his boat. So let's see what he comes up with. But I think the lesson is that there should be further legislation that companies have to make adequate contributions to their pension schemes. And I don't know how that would be framed, because I'm not a pension expert, but I don't think it's entirely the fault of the Bank of England. I think that he just left it too late. I mean, if he did the right contributions during his tenure at BHS, perhaps the situation would not be the dire one that we find ourselves in. And I do find it abhorrent that he's lounging around on his boat while 20,000 people who are either pensioners or just lost their jobs are finding life tough.
Yeah. Okay. Next question is from Linda. Said, hope you're well, Jim. Question on 3D printing firm Aurora Labsyn in Perth. Notice you're a shareholder, and just wondered what you see different at this company than other 3D firms.
Well, that's a good question, Linda. Thank you. I met with the management, David Budge, this last Sunday in London. And pretty impressive it is too. I mean, I think the shares may have run ahead of themselves. They've gone a listing price of 15 instead of about 83, I think, today. And that was only a couple of weeks ago. But it's an interesting concept, because what he's done is he's developed 3D printers for metals. So they use granulated metals to produce additive manufactured parts, which otherwise would be forged or would be made in a kind of iron furnace. And these machines that he's developed are cheap relative to the current ones on the market. They're very fast, and they produce goods to a tolerance that's better than the product. So what's not to like? I mean, I think the big risk there is execution risk. As I said to David, I think, you know, making stuff in Australia is not the best place to do it. But there's a very big market, even the mining industry as an example, to produce goods on the spot, because at the moment they hold vast amounts of inventory, which ties up a lot of working capital. So BHP, for instance, has got $4 billion tied up in spare parts in its various locations. And if you had a 3D printer that could make it on the spot, you wouldn't need to have all that money tied up in working capital. So I think it's a very interesting cost. Execution risk is the main risk.
Okay. All right. And the last few questions are all concerning life. And I know you can't reveal too much, but I'll bunch them all together and you can give a response as to what you feel appropriate here. So first of all, it says, what plans do you have for the company? With the deadline close, is a deal coming closer? Is it an investment or RTO? How positive are the Board of Life getting a material deal complete? So answer that as you feel fit, please. Jim.
Okay, obviously I'm constrained by stock exchange rules and, you know, the rules of the market. But what I can say is that we did not set Life up. It was set up by an entrepreneur called Mike Beck, who invested money in a failed Philippine copper project. It had nothing to do with us. But because the company was administered outside by the Isle of Man office, Burnbrae Limited, when it became effectively a cash shell, we thought that might be a good opportunity for us to use it as a biotech or something in healthcare vehicle. And we're quite aware that a deadline's coming up in October, by which we either have to have made an investment or done an RTO. And the board is working very hard to achieve that. I can't tell you what we're looking at or what we're not looking at. I can't tell you whether it's going to be an RTO or it's going to be an investment, because that would be giving away information I'm not allowed to give away. But I can tell you that we're extremely aware that something needs to be done with Life, and we're very much hoping that we will get it done. So, you know, we have a small holding in this company, but we were determined to do the best for the shareholders.
Marvellous. Jim, listen, thanks very much for your time. I understand you've had to go to a coffee shop to get some internet connection there, so I do appreciate that. And hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's been really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on the Vox Markets website in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, Codal Minerals, KOD, at 4, 88 Energy, ATD, at 3, Alexander Mining, AXM, at 2, I did a podcast this morning with Dave Whitby, the CEO. That's ADL, Andalas Energy and Power. Just signed a partnership with Pertamina, a massive company. And I think you should put this company on your watch list. Share price hasn't risen that much. And I think when you're sort of, you know, a 5 million market cap company and you're hooking up with an $18 billion company, you've got to do some research on this company. You know, what they're doing there is, I mean, it just opens up Indonesia for them, I think. And so I'd definitely put that on your watch list and do some research and just read up on the CVs of the guys involved there. And at number one, like I said, it's a hugely popular company. I had the CEO on last week, and that is CloudTag. Again, number one, I think it was up by 30% yesterday, the share price. So phenomenal rise. Okay, the most liked and disliked RNSs today on the website were: most liked, New World Oil and Gas, an update on the Big Silver Company, and AGM. That's ticker NEW, new. The most disliked RNS was African Potash, subscription and bridge loan update, AFPO. So check those out to see why they're most liked and disliked. All right, today's suggested one for your watch list has been submitted by Paul. Prospect Oil and Gas is a company. What does the company do? Oil and gas, as it suggests. How many shares does the company have in issue? 285 million. What's the current price and market cap? 1.45 pence, and it's 4.14 million. Sorry, 485,000, I think it is. Let me just check. While I'm here, let me just check that. If I can. I think it was, 285 million shares in issue there at Prospect Oil and Gas. How much cash or debt does the company have? On the 10th of August, they raised 775,000, a further 100,000 on the 10th of June, and 1.64 million on the 26th of May. There's three reasons why you think this company has potential. They have an upcoming drill in quarter four at the Bolsor Prospect within Kola license in Poland. The CPR's economic results were used to interpolate indicative net present values, which range from $44 million to $95 million net to prospects. Beaufort Securities state that their valuation is based on an NPV10 at 50 BCF gas power plant development scenario. They risk this by 75% to reflect geological and execution risk, giving an 8.6 million market cap and a valuation at 3 pence. So that's more than double, of course, where it is at the moment, 1.45 pence. Reason two, they're now fully funded for the drill. And reason three, their cash is just over half their market cap. So the potential of success in Poland is not really priced in. That's PXOG, Prospect Oil and Gas. And Paul suggests that's one for your watch list. So check that out. Just go on Vox and search for PXOG. That's it for the podcast. Thank you very much. Listen, I am looking for another stock now for tomorrow's one for your watch list. So please, if you can, fill out the form. Just go to the blog there at sharepickers.com/blog, or just click on the link there and fill in the form. Takes. I also tweet this link out now and again, so if you're on Twitter, you follow me at Vox Podcast or at Sharepickers, I'll tweet it out. Just fill in the form there. It takes about 5 minutes, and I could be featuring you on tomorrow's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.